Charles Darwin is the father of evolutionary theory, but in some ways his co-discoverer, Alfred Russel Wallace, was the more remarkable man. Historian Jane Camerini is the editor of the Alfred Russel Wallace Reader. She sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about the great 19th century naturalist. Wallace was a fearless explorer. He spent 4 grueling years in the Amazon, then barely survived when his ship sank on the return voyage to England. And he promptly sailed off to the East Indies, which he explored for another 8 years. In New Guinea, Wallace first wrote up his theory of natural selection. He sent the manuscript to Charles Darwin, of all people. Darwin panicked because he still had not published his big book on evolution.
His theory that he had worked on for 20 years was about to be smashed. That was his word. And it was finessed by several of his colleagues to present some unpublished material of Darwin's that provided evidence that he understood evolution on top of the manuscript by Wallace. And so the historical record shows a joint contribution in 1858.
And it's worth pointing out that Wallace came from a very different background than Darwin. Darwin was always independently wealthy. His voyage on the Beagle was paid for by his father.
Mm-hmm.
Wallace was from the lower middle class. He had to earn a living. And
mm-hmm.
so he was off gallivanting around the world in the Amazon, later in the Malay Archipelago, collecting specimens to make money so he could send them back to museums.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the other side, one of the advantages of being a worker is that he had less to protect. He didn't have vested interests. He didn't have a status or a family to worry about. And in some way, I think this made him more open-minded, so that he could read about the question of all questions, where do species come from, without as many intellectual and social constraints that someone with a higher social position might have.
So he was, when he was out collecting things, he was what, looking for rare beetles and bird skins and dried plants, that kind of thing?
Making money was never his goal. One of my favorite quotations from Wallace was, "It's okay to be rich, but not to have to get rich. And no one is less suited to getting rich than myself." He was really dedicated to ideas, to science, to his beliefs and opinions, to society. And he had a real disdain for greed and for money-making in and of itself.
He kept a diary during his whole travels, and
mm-hmm.
He has some very vivid accounts of what it was like being out in the field. For one thing, the illnesses that he had to battle. There's one place where he writes about his time in Dobo, New Guinea.
Mm-hmm. Dobo was the port where he arrived, and he went there with the explicit goal of collecting birds of paradise, which had been reported from some French explorers, and Linnaeus had some kind of ratty specimens. But the scientific knowledge about birds of paradise was very scant indeed. No European had seen, as Wallace was able to, birds of paradise in their native habitat.
But it wasn't so easy.
Indeed not.
Ever since leaving Dobo, I had suffered terribly from insects, who seemed here bent upon revenging my long-continued persecution of their race. After our first stopping place, sandflies were very abundant at night, penetrating to every part of the body and producing a more lasting irritation than mosquitoes. My feet and ankles especially suffered, and were completely covered with little red swollen specks which tormented me horribly. After a month's incessant punishment, those useful members rebelled against such treatment and broke into open insurrection, throwing out numerous inflamed ulcers, which were very painful and stopped me from walking. So I found myself confined to the house, and with no immediate prospect of leaving it. Wounds or sores in the feet are especially difficult to heal in hot climates, and I therefore dreaded them more than any other illness. When I crawled down to the riverside to bathe, I often saw the blue-winged Papilio ulysses, or some other equally rare and beautiful insect. But there was nothing for it but patience, to return quietly to my bird-skinning or whatever other work I had indoors.
But then Alfred Russel Wallace goes on to say that there was some consolation. Even when he was sick, he had hired local boys to go out and find these birds of paradise.
And they did, and they had a much more detailed knowledge of their habits, since they had, for trading purposes, learned how to collect these birds for their feathers. And through the help of his own boys, he was able to gather a great deal of information, which was new knowledge for the learned world.
The birds had now commenced what the people here call their sakaleli, or dancing parties, in certain trees in the forest, which are not fruit trees, as I first imagined, but which have an immense head of spreading branches, giving a clear space for the birds to play and exhibit their plumes. On one of these trees, a dozen or 20 full-plumaged male birds assemble together, raise up their wings, stretch out their necks, and elevate their exquisite plumes, keeping them in continual vibration. Between whiles, they fly across from branch to branch in great excitement, so that the whole tree is filled with waving plumes in every variety of attitude and motion. The bird itself is nearly as large as a crow. It is of a rich coffee-brown colour. The head and neck is of a pure straw-yellow above and a rich metallic green beneath. The long, plumy tufts of golden-orange feathers spring from the sides beneath each wing, and, when the bird is in repose, are partly concealed by them. At the time of its excitement, however, the wings are raised vertically over the back, the head is bent down and stretched out, and the long plumes are raised up and expanded till they form two magnificent golden fans, striped with deep red at the base, and fading off into the pale brown tint of the finely divided and softly waving points. When seen in this attitude, the bird of paradise rarely deserves its name, and must be ranked as one of the most beautiful and most wonderful of living things.
Now, we've been talking about the scientific contributions of Alfred Russel Wallace, being the co-founder of the theory of evolution through natural selection. There's a whole other part of his life that's fascinating, his politics. He was a lifelong socialist, and his spiritual life, which he took very seriously.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's not just another part of his life. It's, in fact, more than half of his life. When he returned to England, he was in his 40s, and he knew that he would be shaking the hand of Charles Darwin, that he would come back a respected scientist. And in the course of the 1860s, he became involved with what were then very popular kind of spiritualist movements. In certain social circles, seances and mesmerism and phrenology were very popular.
And this, I mean, this is fascinating to think about. And here is the, you know, this giant in the history of science, and he's participating in seances trying to contact his dead relatives.
Not only that, he brought to it a very serious scientific point of view. He thought so earnestly that it was simply wrong for men of science to assume that they knew, before something had been carefully studied, that they knew something was not possible. So the fact that we can't see any material evidence, or that we can't measure or understand how there could be non-material communication between the spirit world and the real world, well, that was just our limitation. It didn't mean that something wasn't out there.
And this is very different from Darwin, who was much more of a materialist, who wanted to explain the way the world worked through natural selection.
Yeah. Wallace did not continue to be involved with seances and other sort of parapsychological phenomena, but he did incorporate a belief in some special kind of mind, some influx, some spiritual stuff that lay behind a more law-driven, orderly universe.
Is this, in today's terms, what we call intelligent design?
It's not very different from it.
So the sense that there is this higher being, we can call it God if we want, that has sort of laid all this out to happen.
He didn't call it a being, and he really detested organized religion. Rather than talking about a designer, he talked about mind or intelligence.
Which is so interesting in today's context, because those who advocate intelligent design are usually denounced by the evolutionary theorists, by the mainstream scientific community. I mean, intelligent design is usually considered, that's the camp of the creationists.
Yeah, it's interesting that things tend to become so polarized, because in reality, the majority of people at any given time, whether it was before Darwin's work or in the late 19th century or America in 1950. Did we become a materialist society that science changed most people's point of view? Indeed not. In the present day, probably close to half of Americans believe in some sort of God, if you will. And I think the same was true, if not more so, in Wallace's day.
So how did Wallace try to reconcile this? I mean, this sense that there was some intelligence or mind and what he had discovered about evolution.
What comes to mind as you ask that question was, I think, something that Einstein was often quoted as saying, that God doesn't play dice with the universe, that he couldn't imagine it all being a random process. Did all of this really come about by chance? And for Wallace, the answer to that question was clear. It couldn't possibly have been by chance. The sense of purpose to the universe and to all of evolution, from inorganic through organic and then spiritual evolution, is all unified. And the purpose is the evolution of the human spirit.
The higher mental or spiritual nature of man is not the mere animal nature advanced through survival of the fittest. All the greatest writers and thinkers on the subject now admit this. Darwin himself declared that the law of natural selection was, in his opinion, the greatest but not the exclusive means of modification. The whole universe, in all its myriad forms, in all its intricacies of structure and motion, in all its marvelous beauty and inexhaustible utilities, in all its complex and mysterious laws and forces, became to man a vast schoolroom, furnishing the materials needed for the development of all his hitherto unused faculties, and for the gradual elevation of his intellectual and moral nature. But the possibilities of such development must have pre-existed. Every faculty must have been latent, or no amount of marvel and mystery could have called them forth. How this higher nature originated in man, we may never know, but all the evidence points in the direction of some spiritual influx, analogous to that which first initiated the organized life of the plant, then the consciousness and intelligence of the animal, and lastly, reason. The sense of beauty, the love of justice, the passion for truth, the aspiration towards a higher life, which everywhere, though in varying degrees, characterized the human race.
Now, the other piece of Wallace's life, which in some ways was perhaps more important than anything we've been talking about so far, was his passion for social justice. I mean, he was politically very committed to the notion that all people were created equal. And he had some radical ideas. I mean, for instance, he didn't believe in the ownership of land.
That's right. In fact, that's kind of where his socialism had its roots, in his early experiences as a land surveyor. And he was very inspired by his experiences in the field, by looking at how people who were not of European culture solved some of the problems of social justice, of education and caring for children and crime. And he actually believed that many of these so-called primitive cultures had done a far better job than Western civilization had done.
So when you look back on the career of Alfred Russel Wallace, what do you make of it?
I take Wallace as kind of a hero, because he had so much goodness and love for humanity. And he, in spite of all the suffering and losses that he experienced in his life, he was an inveterate optimist. And so I feel like I'm here transmitting some of his karma to let some of his message, which is still just as apt as it was when he wrote and spoke it, that for Wallace, being fair and being truthful really mattered.
Jane Camerini is a historian of science and the editor of the Alfred Russel Wallace Reader. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Thanks to Paul Bosing for his readings.